What's up, traders? Anthony Crudelli here, and welcome to the Futures Radio Show podcast. In today's episode, I'm joined by two of the greatest minds in the futures space, Andy Constant and Jimmy Jude. We're going to discuss the market momentum, the pressure facing the Fed, the AI boom, and much more. With combined decades of experience in macro, quantitative research, and technical analysis, this is a conversation you don't want to miss. Let's get started. Today's podcast is sponsored by TradeStation. Serious futures traders, level up your skills with TradeStation's powerful platform. Enjoy flexibility, superior trading power, and save big with 50% off brokerage fees for the life of your account. Open a new futures account today at TradeStation.com/Anthony and get 10% intraday margin rates on three popular futures markets. Discover why TradeStation is my go-to platform for trading options on futures. Explore the robust platform now at TradeStation.com/Anthony. Andy Constant has 35 years in global markets. Andy's expertise in macro investing was honed at Bridgewater and Brevan Howard. Previous roles include head of global equity derivatives at Salomon. He's founded two hedge funds specializing in multi-asset volatility and capital structure arbitrage. His career merges systematic quantitative research with discretionary investing insights. Andy is the founder of macroeconomic research firm, Damped Springs. Jimmy began his career in 1994 as a market maker at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, trading options in the Eurodollar pit. Transitioning to screen trading in 2004, he gained expertise in technical analysis while handling European indexes and energy forward curves. Returning to the pits in 2005 to navigate natural gas futures volatility, Jimmy later specialized in trading the VIX curve and S&P options before venturing into independent trading in 2016. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Anthony, how are you? Great to see you, brother.
Great to have you guys. You guys are coming off a little bender in Miami. So hopefully you guys are fully recovered as we record here on Monday. So that looked like a great time with the whole Damp Spring crew and out there in Miami.
Yeah, it was really humbling. Clients flew into Miami to meet us. And the group that was there that lives down there was just a great group of people. We accomplished a lot. It was a lot of fun.
I'm sure Jimmy was on his best behavior too, weren't you, Jimmy?
Of course. It was a great time. I blame Nick Wentz for the condition I'm in right now. It was mostly his fault. And I really, what are you going to say to an MMA fighter, you know? I tell him no, I need to go home early.
No, I don't argue.
It was great having him there, though. I tell you, that guy is as funny and smart as he is on Twitter, and he'll beat the shit out of anyone at the bar that messes with you. Absolutely. So it's a win-win when you're with him.
You feel so safe.
Safe.
True. Oh, that's awesome. And you guys have built up an amazing community with Damp Spring, and I'm sure we're going to get into that today. You know, right now, let's talk about markets. I mean, the markets have been so quiet. I mean, volatility has just been sucked out of this market right now. And, you know, what's so interesting is that you would think almost that there would be some more volatility as we go back to November and really how markets were pricing in 6 to 7 cuts, Andy. Right now it's like 2 to 3. And you've really been on this story. You said, I remember looking at one of your tweets in December where you're like, I'm going to almost say that one of my things for this year is that the Fed doesn't cut. At that time, everyone was like 6 to 7 cuts. All this is happening. And now we're down 2 to 3. And, you know, Andy, I think we start with you just about this macro backdrop. What are your thoughts on why we're seeing volatility just sucked out of the market and why you think the market is doing what it's doing?
Yeah, sure. So I guess the big picture is I've been sort of resident on Higher for Longer Island for 15 months or so, maybe even longer, maybe almost 2 years, basically expecting the economy to do extremely well, real GDP to be strong, and inflation to come down but remain above target. And, you know, that's where I've been for a long time. And in that environment, the Fed hikes more than expected and pauses for longer than expected. And I think we're at a transition point right now. I think that view has now become reality to most folks. And so even when you have what I think was a very dovish FOMC meeting last week, you don't have 7 cuts priced into markets any again, even though in December, when you had similar dovish action in, at the around the FOMC, you got those 7 cuts. So I think people are recognizing now that this cutting cycle is not a lead up to an imminent recession where they're going to cut back down to zero. And that's taken a lot of volatility out of the market.
So how are you positioned now with that opinion of what's happening in the marketplace?
Yeah. So when I was, when I set off to Higher for Longer Island, it was lonely. No one was out there thinking that the Fed was going to continue to hike all the way up to 5. We're thinking about 5.25. But 5.25. They were thinking about going to 5.5. No one was there. And everyone expected a recession. And equity prices were lower. You know, they struggled to get through 4,000, finally did, then went right back to 4,200 on the fall. And so people just didn't accept that you could have, and interest rates were low across the curve. They didn't accept that you could have an environment where real GDP is strong. Sorry about that. Real GDP is strong and inflation comes down, but doesn't necessarily come down to target. They just weren't there. And so now I look at the environment and look at pricing and see economic consensus, sort of like the surveys. You look at all of the economic forecasts for inflation, for growth, and you look at how the Fed changed the SCP recently from 1.4% GDP growth for 2024 all the way up to 2.1%. And also increase their inflation expectation from 2.4 to 2.6 for core PCE. And that just reflected where the most economists are. And the important thing that I know have noticed is it's not just most economists, every economist, the distribution of expectations for this economy is modestly above trend growth and inflation modestly above target. And no one, not a single analyst or economist is predicting a recession, as surveyed by Bloomberg, is predicting a recession in 2024 or 2025. Wow, that's a big shift from where we were for all of 2022 and 2023. And I feel like the higher for longer high and that nominal GDP has become the crowded trade right now. And you see it now. So that's economists' outlook. Then you see, look at the market pricing and you see high yield credit spreads pushing down below 300 basis points for the first time in a long time. You see triple B spreads to single B to triple B spreads at their lowest they've ever been in history. And you recognize that an equity prices are, you know, we have a 11% year over year for 2 years estimated analyst estimates for growth. You have a 20.5, 21 forward multiple. And, you know, those are pricing for no recession. And so the things I'm looking at are not that rosy. And again, I've been the rosiest for the longest. And they're not pricing, the things I'm looking at are no longer pricing that rosiness. So I think it's time to leave and it's time to head toward a situation where the two outcomes that may occur are soft landing or hard landing. Whereas, again, for years now, I've been no land.
Jimmy, you come at this from a little bit of a different perspective. I know you look at what's happening in the VIX curves. You look at what's happening in the options markets. You know, hearing Andy talk about really the backdrop from the macro side on what the economists are looking at, I look to you to see what is happening from the technical side. How are the options markets positioned right now, or lack of positions in these markets?
Right. Well, options are, it's cheap. You know, everything's cheap. Skew is flat. There's not a lot of respect for risk right now. But, you know, in the same respect, you have this like grinding rally in equities, relentless grinding rally in equities. So there's not much impetus to reach for vol, you know, or options. You know, technically, I'll start with the VIX curve. You know, the front of the curve has like a decent slope to it. Doesn't really tell you much. It still seems very benign. If you move out the May, June, July fly, that one's flat to negative. So that could be signaling that people are hedging and expecting some volatility, you know, within the next 30 to 45 days. So if there's anything in the curve, there's that little blip that there might be something on the horizon. But in reality, you know, like the technicals aren't exactly telling you that, not in the equities, you know, or any other spot right now. You know, you've seen these charts. This looks almost like a 2017, you know, grinding chart that, you know, you have to be careful. It's hard to get in front of some or fade something like that because we've seen it last longer in history. We've seen markets like this last longer than we thought they were going to last. So, you know, technically, and the fact that they're making all-time highs, it's a little bit trickier to, you know, find resistance and targets up above. You know, you're now relying on wave counts and Fibonacci extensions. But there is, you know, there is some structural stuff. Like if you move out to the SPX, you know, the cash chart, we are trading in a pretty defined channel right now. So we do have some structural resistance above from the top of that channel and that we are banging off of. But, you know, just because like that's stopping us, I can't necessarily flip and say, all right, I'm, you know, I'm bearish equities now until really we break that channel to the bottom of that channel or break some type of support and get, you know, break a low and change the sequence on these charts. Until then, it's still a dip buyer's market. You know, in the SPOOs, like right now, or say we were talking to, I know a lot of people trade ES, you know, like my, like we'd have to get under 5,200, get under back underneath at 20-day EMA before we can really start having serious conversations that we're starting a correction. Up until then, you know, we really just have to play the charts that are in front of us.
So after hearing what Andy's commentary is about the markets in years, one word comes to my mind, complacency. It feels like that's kind of where we are, right? I mean, we talk about that a little bit, Jimmy. I mean, looking at the options markets, when you say they're cheap, and I kind of set you up for saying is, you know, what are the positions showing or the lack of positions, right? Is this one of those times where maybe we're just in this sweet spot of the market where we're in this trend channel and it just could continue to go on and we all kind of just accepted it?
We could be. I think the one thing that could knock us off the track is say the numbers keep coming in warm or don't show any improvement. You know, it's hard to see how they would, or, you know, there's a wind behind their backs just with assets being, you know, jacked up to all time highs and the speculation and now crypto, you know, like housing at its highs, housing numbers still looking pretty decent, you know, so it's hard to believe that we're going to like inflation's going to crash or, you know, they're going to see any big dips. And as Andy's been preaching, you know, there's a lot of issuance coming into the back of the curve as well. So if something's going to knock us off, it's probably going to be the back of the curve selling off in reaction to maybe the numbers not coming in the way the Fed hopes they will. And the Fed all of a sudden seems like they're behind the curve or maybe somewhat delusional and, you know, and you have an upheaval in the back of the curve, that could cause something, you know? But until you see that, it's going to be difficult to knock the train off the rails, I think, you know?
Right. And as it relates to fixed income, it's not just an equity vol story. In the last couple of days, well, today, the MOVE index hit a new low for, gosh, since QT started. And, you know, so that's over a two-year low. And you look across the entire fixed income vol cube and you'll find that pretty much any spot on the curve is between 20% and 25% fewer basis points per year vol change. So vol is down across the fixed income vol complex as well. And so the question I think you have to ask if you're bullish assets, which I'm not, I still think cash is a great asset to own relative to everything else. If you're bullish assets, you have to say to yourself, are vols at new lows in MOVE and, you know, a 13-ish level that's been persistent almost all year, are those levels you want to sell or are those levels you want to buy? Because you have to want to sell those levels of vol to be long assets at this stage, because that's how they're going to rally in a low vol way. And I don't want to sell vol here.
No. And you know what? Vol markets, like people forget, you know, there's human beings in there, you know, that have bought vol and lost, you know, bought vol and lost all year long. So, you know, there's a psychology that creeps in, even though you know it's cheap, you're just less inclined to keep trying. You know, I tried to fight that in 2017, right before Volmageddon. You know, vol was just way too cheap for me to sell. I had to be long it. And, you know, I had to rob Peter to pay Paul all year long to pay for that premium to remain long. it's a fucking grind. Your P&L goes nowhere, but maybe it leaks down, you know, it's difficult. And that's why you get in these positions. But then there's that one moment and boom, you know, everything kind of explodes and all of a sudden vol matters again, you know. Plus you get guys, you will get young vol traders selling it down here, you know, like guys that I, you know, that aren't very experienced in these matters. Well, you know, lever up and get short this stuff and they'll be a tender for the explosion later, but you know.
And those guys are the same guys that are levering up long, you know, whatever stock you want to pick that's up 300, 400, 500% or any asset like crypto or cocoa or whatever it might be, that's, you know, exploding on the upside.
Jim, explain that the vol a little bit more, because I think that a lot of people are under a misconception of actually how that works. Just talk about that trade when you say you're long it and people are shorted. Explain a little bit more in detail exactly how they're executing that.
Right. Well, you know, normally, usually, and the way I executed it, you know, I was always like long vol through the curve and through spreads and through butterflies and things like that. But you can just be long. I mean, you could be long in the form of, a, you know, spoo straddles, strangles, anything, you know, with premium into it. And, you know, the only way to pay for it depends on what structure you have, but you have to scalp. You have to scalp the gamma. You have to scalp futures and the underlying in order to pay for that premium that you're sitting on. And you have to do it perfectly. Everyone thinks it's such a no-brainer to be, you know, long, if things are moving, to be long options and to be, you know, long gamma. You know, if anyone's ever hedged their gamma early and knows that frustration, knows that it's not a no-brainer. It's, you have to be technically perfect in the underlying, and you have to constantly be, you know, buying and scalping out of your shitty options that are constantly being offered in your face. So it's really a labor-intensive trade to keep long and not just sit there long premium and watch this stuff rot on you, you know?
And what does that tell you about the state of the market then? I said complacency. And so is this a type of market, when we go to both of you guys on this, that maybe we just are going to be in this type of environment for a period of time, where we're just maybe just stuck in this channel and the S&P, I mean, NASDAQ, I mean, maybe we can maybe touch base a little bit on small caps. I'm curious what Andy thinks about that, because they're a lot more tied to lower interest rates. That doesn't seem to be really necessarily happening at the moment. But as a trader, I always look at market environment and I look at this environment and just say, we just feel stuck. And I feel like the Fed has really done a good job of talking dovish, but really not doing anything about it. And, go, you know, Andy, you talked about how you said they were a very dovish meeting, but I continue to look at the tape and I feel like the market just seems to be very content with where we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the point, which is the Fed hasn't really been challenged. Not for years. Once they started the hiking cycle, they, you know, they were late to that. We all know that. But once they started the hiking cycle, they've just hiked. Told us what they're going to do and hiked and hiked and hiked as expected, paused with like with significant amount of conditioning and lead time. And now we've been conditioned, though they've done nothing since September, we've been conditioned that they're going to cut in June. You know, that's just been, you know, essentially it's been perfect, right? The Fed has conditioned us perfectly to get the outcome that they think they can deliver. But yes, they also haven't been challenged. They haven't had a circumstance where the numbers start going in a way that is different than they desire. And so I see it two possibilities to create a catalyst. One is that data comes in. Firstly, data has to come in inconsistent with the direction they want things to go in. Then is the volatile event. And there's two possible ways that can play out. And it has a big difference in terms of what it does to bond markets versus stock markets. If they get some data that doesn't play out well for them, either the economy weakens rapidly, like they get an unexpected negative surprise on the economy, which Powell actually mentioned a little bit of while in his dovishness, or they get an inflation prints that stay hot, then they may have to act in a way that the market isn't prepared for. Or they may not act on that data. And that lack of action will create a catalyst. And so it's not a matter of complacency. For me, I need the data to be differentiated versus what the Fed is guiding us to, and then watch what they do, because that'll either pin or unpin volatility, depending on what they do when that data comes around.
I love the way you put that, Andy, because that's exactly kind of the point I was trying to get at, is that the Fed really hasn't been challenged, right? They have trained us to consistently believe them, even though the dot plots have always been wrong. I mean, I don't know one that's really been right, but you come out of these meetings and I just feel like they've done such a great job. And like I said, in terms of sucking the volatility out of the market and believing that they're able to achieve what they say they're going to achieve. That's what I mean when I say that they've done a great job, because as a trader, I look at it and go, I'm not you, Andy. I don't know anything what's going on in the backdrop like the way that you do or Jimmy does, but I look at the marketplace and go, I feel like the market is just looking at this going, that's why I say complacent and content, because just keep doing it. Look at they're doing what they're doing. And, you know, I go back to you, Jimmy, with the options market. It's just nobody really pricing out, or you're not seeing a lot of people, I guess, protecting using the options market. Any sort of derailment of this?
The only thing I can see that's on the sly is that butterfly. The May, June, July butterfly, that's the only place that I like in the curve or in vol markets that I'm seeing a little bit of hedging on the sly. With that fly still trading negative. In the past, that's been indicative of people hedging an event that no one sees coming. So that's the only place really that I have my eye on right now as maybe a harbinger of things to come. But, you know, like as Andy said, I feel like, you know, the Fed right now it reminds me of like at least Powell's policy. I think he thinks he's, you know, like when your big brother used to like, you know, stop the car like 30 feet ahead of you and you'd run up to it. And as soon as you got your hand on the handle, he'd go up like 30 feet late, you know, more. And he'd be like, all right, this time, no, come on, you know. And then you'd finally stop running. You'd be like, come on, no, this time you can, I'm going to let you in. Like, that's like their policy right now. I don't think, you know, they're teasing, but that's a danger. To tease right now is somewhat dangerous because, you know, if we do get some disappointing prints here, you know, you could have anarchy in the back of the curve. You could have, you know, finally they could get tested. That's really like the major thing that's on the horizon. So we really have to keep an eye. Macro is going to be huge. That's going to be our tell, you know, and I don't think we're not going to really see any action until we start seeing next month's numbers roll in. We kind of know what PCE is going to be, right?
Yep.
So they're very accurate now at forecasting that once they have CPI and PPI. Although it still seems somewhat disappointing to me. I guess some of the year-over-year numbers aren't going to look that bad. But still, there's not a lot of room for error here. You know, we can't have another round of numbers like that next month. You know, we have to see some improvements under the current policy.
So Andy, we hear from Jimmy, and you don't see a lot of people using the options markets in the short term. I guess I wouldn't say not that they're not protecting against some volatility, but just no one's projecting it. Maybe that's the better word, right? What other ways out there do you see that maybe the market's pricing in some potential risk? I mean, look at gold, look at Bitcoin. I don't know where you feel about those and where they sit and all of that, but I just looking at the overall market environment is you know, what else are you seeing to where maybe there is showing some signs of where people are putting money, saying, look, there could be some unknown things coming up?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't see a lot of portfolio insurance, portfolio protecting amongst most standard investors. Hedge fund positioning is not particularly large. Long-only asset managers are pretty levered up, but you know that's what they're paid for, and that's what they do in a trending market like we've had. And so, you know, that's a yellow flag in terms of concern if something starts to unwind. But I don't see anything different. Credit spreads are tight. You know, people can generally buy protection on credit if they think there's going to be an event, and none of that's going on. And you look at Dixie and you look at the currency market broadly, and that's also an extremely narrow range. So not only does it mean that the US is not going to have a data blip, it means the rest of the world isn't going to have a data blip. So we're really set up for, you know, continued data that looks good. And there's no reason to believe it won't. I'm not saying that, hey, gosh, that should, you know, all of a sudden data is going to go one way or the other. I'm just saying we're more exposed to it than normal.
Andy, talk a little bit more about the credit spreads. This is something that's just above my pay grade. Explain why that's important. You've brought that up a few times, why that's very important to watch right now.
Right. So credit spreads are the spread one gets above a risk-free rate to take on the risk of a default. And when you are paid a lot for that, taking on that risk, the spreads are extremely wide. And when you're paid very, very little, the spreads are low. And so people are willing to take on credit risk of high yield companies, of investment grade companies, of any credit risky asset at very, very low compensation, which means they're willing to take a risk that one of the companies or the index of companies they're trading isn't going to suffer any defaults. And so that says that we're just going to slog through. We're not only just slog through, the economy is going to do well. And all the underlying credits are going to do well. So it just doesn't give you any degree of safety.
Understood. Jimmy, I want to go to a tweet that you put out a little while ago. You said from October to January, the markets made a monumental shift to easy and continued as we digested cool macro from a period when the Fed was actually tight July to October. Now that easiness is filtering into the numbers, while everyone is still expecting the macro inflation data to keep trending lower, don't be zigging when you should be zagging. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, that's just a natural propensity in the markets to always, you know, always be on the wrong side. Always, you know, by the time they wake up to a trend, it's usually the end of the trend. And what I was speaking about that point is when Janet punted in October and caused, you know, created the rally in the curve, created the rally in equities, that was, you know, financial conditions overall like eased majorly. And then we got all the numbers from back in October when financial conditions were really tight. So it's kind of like the numbers and the markets move like this. And so now we're in this moment where, you know, we're at all-time highs in the stock market, you know, housing's still doing relatively well. It's, you know, the volume isn't there, but still, you know, it's, you know, price hasn't come off at all. At that point, don't look for the same type of trend that we were seeing back in October, because financial conditions are vastly different now. It's a lot easier, and it's going to be harder to get those cool numbers that we saw rolling in November and December. But that was, you know, that was from a period and interest rates were a lot higher and stocks were a lot lower. So, I still feel like we're in a very positive, a much easier environment. The only thing I could maybe point to as something that could slow the economy down, and it's anecdotal, but the fact that the housing market has slowed so much, and just that, like, you know, the fact that the populace is kind of stuck and isn't moving around as much, that churn, you know, that does cause a lot of economic activity. You know, every time you move, every time you buy a new home, you know, and if people are sedentary, I could see that like creeping into the economy, you know, like financial conditions. I still think it's under the current environment, it's going to be hard to see improvement in inflation numbers over the next 30, 40 days, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know, momentum is a powerful force. And the people that get in early and get out in time are the people that make the alpha. And the question is, where are we on that? And as you said, Anthony, you know, it can go for a year without a catalyst that deflects it where every dip gets bought. And we've been going now for, call it 5 months. It's hard to tell when it'll end. I think it'll end when we have that divergence between the data and the Fed's wishes in one way or the other.
I want to get to your thoughts on how we play the next quarter going out as we're getting near the end of the quarter. But I quickly want to bring up AI because I think that it's such an important part of what's happening in this marketplace right now. It's funny, you know, sometimes you sit back, you watch TV, and I throw on some of the business news or I watch tweets, and it's interesting for me to see that Lululemon's maybe struggling here or McDonald's. People don't want to go and spend money on clothes or McDonald's is getting downgraded, but yet everybody's going to have an NVIDIA chip, right? I mean, you know, and I know, and I look at things from maybe not the smartest macro perspective, but I look at the overall things of what's happening. And this AI boom is something to where I'm just, obviously, I'm not educated enough on AI to know how much it's going to impact all of us. I know that I definitely have started to use it, but I'm curious what you guys think. I mean, when you look at this right now, is this one of those things that you guys have looked into and said, this is actually something that is not just a boom for now, it's going to have significant impact going forward and it could continue to carry the markets? Maybe we start with you, Jimmy, and then we go to Andy.
Well, Andy has a much better, well-informed opinion on this.
That's why I wanted you to go first.
mine is like yours. Mine comes from a hardcore trading standpoint. You know, obviously, I don't understand, you know, all the components to it. I feel like from a trader standpoint, it's like, great. This is, you know, they've invented a new reason to pump this stuff that I can't understand right away. Right. You know, the dot-com bubble was easier to understand because you could point at something and say, that's a stupid idea. You know, there's no way this is going to work and that's going to work. You know, it was really obvious. So, you know, this is more like kind of like crypto to me, where I'm like, geez, you know, obviously there's value there. I don't really understand it. You know, the math seems a little crazy. You know, valuations seem a little crazy. I'm certainly not in the position to completely know the truth. I know that prices can get, you know, in this situation, because there's guys like me out there, prices can get dumber because there is no, it's hard to point a finger at it. Now, Andy's broken down some of the math on it, and he has an opinion that probably may, you know, makes a little more sense than just my conjecture. But
well, yeah, Andy,
so, why don't you give him yours?
Yeah, Andy, I make a joke, like, you know, people can't afford Lululemon right now, or they're struggling, or McDonald's is getting downgraded. But yet NVIDIA is just, people are going to spend the money on it. And I know
Did you see the tweet? I forget who tweeted it out this morning, but it was a toothbrush that now uses right? Like, I mean, Jesus Christ, is, you know, like, God, when I see that kind of stuff, then I know I really don't want to buy it, you know, like, not yet. I'll buy the dip, or I'll buy whenever. But you know what? That doesn't mean it couldn't double from here. And, you know, and the dip is here when it comes back. That's the hard part about momentum trades that you can't really prove. I don't know. Andy, talk.
So, you know, as a systematic trader for most of my career, I've always used advanced technologies. You know, pairs trading was about regressions. Then you used more complicated mathematics to come up with high frequency trading strategies, and spent a fair amount of time using AI and neural networks and all of the classic tools that have been available, really, that really took off maybe 10 years ago, when cloud computing lowered the cost of those activities. And, you know, I consider so far this is just along the path of that. And it all came to the public's better understanding with large language models. But it's all part of the trend that's been going on for decades in terms of using analytical models to help humans operate their lives. Now, as it relates to this most recent, you know, since the OpenAI ChatGPT thing became something that my 83-year-old mother knows about, clearly the beneficiary has been the chip makers. And that's the classic picks and shovels story, and a totally reasonable thing. And there have been some wins that have been, you know, then there's the rest of the group. That is the potential beneficiaries of AI development using, and those are the hyperscalers that can offer their cloud services. And then there's the people that actually are going to make money selling AI tools to people. And the last group, there's no revenue there, or modest revenue at best. Even with the hyperscalers, their revenue-oriented stuff is future revenue, not current revenue. And so you look at these things and you say, yeah, NVIDIA should be a dominant player in this. And then the question is it worth it? You know, I look at their client base and the amount of CapEx that that client base has done and the total amount of CapEx that they typically do and project that. And it's very hard to get to NVIDIA's growth numbers without some new cohort coming in and spending on these chips. And so you see the goals of NVIDIA to get sovereigns to invest in their chips and to get the old people that bought the older chip to invest in the new, faster chip. And all of those things are late cycle to me in terms of the picks and shovels, even though the growth potential is large, because you're reaching the macroeconomic capacity for CapEx from the buyers, from their customers, without offsetting revenues. If there was a revenue source that was paying in the space, not the picks and shovels, but the actual AI tools, then you could see that CapEx increase more rapidly than it's likely to. Then I look at the companies broadly that I just described, those ones that are not the picks and shovels, but are the ones that are, you know, major beneficiaries of the AI revolution. And the way I look at it is, currently these companies, the, call it the Mag Six, what, call it whatever mag you want, are generating sales equal to about 6% of the US GDP. So they're a major portion of the economy. On the other hand, to grow the rest of the GDP of the United States is everything from, you know, military to Social Security to, you know, the food we consume, the clothes we manufacture or buy, whatever it might be, it's very hard to get a significant increase in share of GDP. And even if you were to increase your share from 6% to, say, 7%, that's a $250 billion revenue nut. And that then has to be split amongst all the people that are trying to eat from that pie. And the way I look at valuations at this stage, I don't know which of the people is going to get a whole serving of pie, but there isn't enough pie for everyone. And so they're all priced as if they can get a full serving of pie. And either everyone's going to have to take half a slice, or somebody's going to get no pie and the other guy's going to get a full share. But when it plays out, you're going to see some meaningful winners and losers. And that will, to me, result in the topping of this type of AI hype. And when it happens, who knows?
Yeah. Well, it just means if you're along the other people that don't have the big piece of the pie, tight stops, baby, tight stops. So I want to end today with this. It was great to hear the macro backdrop, what's going on with the technicals through Jimmy, what's happening in the options markets. But now we're almost through Q1, right? I think everyone's looking at, okay, this is the market we have. How do we trade it going forward? We start with you, Jimmy. With all the things that you're looking at, talk to us maybe about how you're positioned or what you'll be looking to do if X happens in the coming days and weeks as we get into Q2.
Well, we're in the midst of looking to protect ourselves on the upside in the equity market and cover our upside with some cheap calls, you know, buying a dip here. But we're also going to leave some optionality on the downside. We're always going to be either long puts or some put spreads in this scenario. And we may have to rob Peter to pay Paul to pay for it, but it'll be a position where if it goes down, it'll be profitable. If it goes up, it won't hurt. If it stays right here, it is probably the worst case scenario. And I think that's how we're going to be approaching the equities. I still like shorts in the back of the curve right now under these scenario. I think, you know, I mean, we are in an election year. We can't deny that either. And, you know, we were talking about it this weekend and we were trying to come up with like all bullshit excuses on the market narratives. And one of the things that we were talking about is, you know, it might be the type of situation where the election, you know, you're thinking, well, if people are thinking Biden's going to win, he's going to have to juice this thing into the election in order to win. He's going to have help from Treasury and the Fed is going to have to like stay non-aggressive. You know, in that scenario, that's probably, you know, supportive of equities going into the elections. On the flip side, if you're thinking Trump's going to win, you know, that might be supportive of equities too, because animal spirits, Trump's going to pull back regulations. So, you know, I think there's like somewhat of a wind at your back on the election process, you know. But once again, like the problem is if the numbers don't come in, we are in the middle of an election. How the fuck do you explain that to everybody? You know, that's going to be a shit show. The current administration is going to be scrambling. And I don't know if you can just like BS through hardcore macro numbers like that. And on the flip side, the Trump administration is going to be hammering them for causing inflation and letting inflation run like this and how it's hurting the most, you know, vulnerable in society. So, you know, that's kind of where I am mentally going into the rest of the year. I'm not delusional. I realize that we could keep going in equities under that premise. But I also look at, you know, I just look at the environment and it seems like a tinderbox for some higher inflation prints going forward and maybe, you know, a moment in the near future where the Fed does have to explain itself or the Fed is caught and impressed into a situation.
Andy, before I get into what you think about Q2 and how you'd potentially be playing it, I want to stay on the Fed into an election year. You know, the Fed always says, oh, we're not a political body, right? But I mean, Andy, I'm curious, what do you think? I mean, do you think that if they do get challenged, this was a topic of conversation today, if the Fed finally does get challenged, do you think that politics could play a role of what the Fed does?
I really don't know. Until they get challenged, when they get challenged and they make a political decision, we'll know. If they don't get challenged, it's hard to claim that they're being political.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's where I'm saying, okay, I hear that the Fed's supposed to be political. There's no evidence that they ever have been in the past, like literally no evidence of changes in policy around trying to get a particular president elected. They've hiked 8 out of the last 13 elections during the election year. No evidence of it happening, but I believe it. Everyone tells me that they're political, so I have to listen to them. There's no evidence. Now the next thing is challenge me. Tell me, show me where they make a politically motivated decision. Cutting when inflation is coming down is not political. So anyway, that's my view. Now, let me come back to positioning. So Jimmy and I work together. So he's stole some of my thunder. We've been wrong on equities for, call it 3 months, and it's been painful. You can blame animal spirits. You can blame, we've just been short and not willing to buy this momentum move. And we've missed that. At the same time, we've been short bonds since December. December 28th, I think, is when we first went short bonds. And we've been short pretty much across the curve. And that's at least covered most of our losses on equities. And so we're not having a particularly good quarter. And it's pissing us off, pissing me off for sure. As it relates to equities, right this second, I'm short. By the end of the week, I'm going to have bought some slightly out of the money calls to make sure that if we do rally again through the, I think there's some quarter end flows that are negative. So I'm going to try to take advantage of that to buy some out of the money calls to at least not lose money anymore on the upside. Bonds, on the other hand, I'm very committed to that and unwound some of our short last week. We're putting more of it back on this week. Again, I think there's some supportive flows for fixed income for the end of the month. And the trade we're trying to do at this stage, because as I said, I think that the economy is that peak optimism for the economy is upon us. You wouldn't want to short bonds into that. But what you would want to do is a steepener. And so for the first time, I'm actually going to be long twos, maybe as far out as fives, but probably around twos and short tens and 30s, which is consistent with my view that supply is going to be coming to market to push out that spread and also hedged in the event that the economy does weaken meaningfully and home run if they cut and inflation roars back. So, you know, that's the principal risks we'll have by the end of the week. And, you know, I always have a long beta. It's hot, heavy cash right now, but I'm always long assets for my long-term personal accounts. But let me just kick a couple more trade ideas down at you. I think the yen is going to see 160. And the reason being that the BOJ is going to have to remain, and the MOF is going to have to remain accommodative for them to maintain their inflation and growth. I'm looking at commodities as, if I'm right on the economy weakening, I think the commodity rally that we've seen is going to actually take a breather. And so I'm looking for an entry point on certain commodities that are not in the sweet spot of industrial demand and are not supply constrained. And the one that's the most obvious to me is oil at this point. So I'm looking for an entry point short oil.
Got it. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And you know what? I just wanted to let everybody know, Damn Spring, what a great team. I love you guys. It's great to see you guys adding Shy Girl. We all know how much I love my Shy. I know you guys don't go out there and you guys do your thing. But explain to everybody what makes you guys special and why people should go take a look at what you guys are doing at Damn Spring.
I love the relationship that we have. We're two completely different people from two different spectrums. And we look at markets differently too. So there's a lot of conversation and debate about what we're seeing. I learn a ton from Andy, the front of the curve, the plumbing of the market. You know, in that respect, I'm a student and a client as much as I am a partner. But, you know, because of our diverse backgrounds and experiences, I think that blend, someone called us the odd couple. And it wasn't just, you know, because we're two different guys. We're really very similar people, but we just have such drastic, you know, different backgrounds and from what angle we look at the markets. I think when you put it together, you know, we can usually come up with a decent thesis and decent entries and exits when it's time to execute on our thoughts.
Yeah, I think the number one value to the Damp Spring community is access, openness, and accountability. We spend a tremendous amount of time with our clients. If they have a question of any sort at any time, it gets addressed rapidly in a thoughtful way. And so our community values us by the fact that you can sort of just you know, tap the thinking of someone who's been there and done that for a long, long time. And it's what I enjoy the most is paying forward my learning to a new audience that doesn't have the experience I have. Don't come for the trades. You know, are we any good? Our returns are okay. 55% win ratio, good Sharpe ratio. You know, all that stuff is great. But we're not day traders. We're not going to hit wins all the time. But if you want to get better as an investor, Damp Springs the place to come.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, I have so much respect for the two of you. I am constantly learning from the two of you. It's really an honor to have you guys on the podcast together because I just look up to both of you guys and think that you guys do an absolutely fantastic job in the FinTwit community, FinX now maybe community, whatever you want to call it. But you two are great leaders in it. And I really appreciate you guys. Thank you so much for coming back on Futures Radio Show.
Thanks, Anthony. Anytime.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it. Great to see you, brother.